Right, so I'm going to talk about simulations of galaxy formation. And if anything, you should take away what are eagles, owls, and other gimmicks.
So there's a minimum requirement for leaving the room.
So contents, any talk has this slide. So I'm going to talk about the basics. What do we want? What can we do? Does it work? And in case we don't make it to the end, you know this already. Basics, what do we want? It's rather obvious. What can we do? Does it work sometimes? What did we learn? I'll leave that up to you. Eagles and owls, what it stands for.
So we're done, right?
Where do we go from here? Yeah, we go to the pub. So, pretty picture to start with. I guess everybody knows this. The problem of simulating galaxies is the very large dynamic range. We want to resolve the star-forming regions and the cores within them. And then we want to say something about how these affect the galaxies themselves. That's already a factor of 10,000 in linear scale. And then actually we want to know also how these galaxies are distributed, and that's another factor of 10,000 in scale. So that's the problem, right? We can't do all these scales yet in one calculation, but that's in the end the aim of what we want to do. So since we can't do that, we have to set some limitations somewhere in scale. Like, we don't go below this scale, and we don't go above that scale. And so you miss physics on the scales below, where you can't resolve things what are happening. And eventually you run into problems of cosmic variance, potentially, because you don't resolve the large scales either. So within that, we need to operate somewhere. We want to also then understand, so I guess the problem is not just, or the aim is not just that we want to have a simulation that goes all the way from the large scale power to individual stars, although I would be very happy if I had a simulation like that. But also we want to understand a bit of what is going on in this simulation. Suppose you have your simulation that looks exactly like the universe. You would write lots of papers, but they wouldn't actually explain why the simulation does that. So there should be some understanding along the way. So arguably, so we discussed this a bit this weekend, but the growth of the dark matter structures is a solved problem in the sense that different codes agree. You can do resolution studies. There's maybe some issue of what happens at the very smallest scales, but at least the dark matter halo lumps, if you resolve them with 1,000 particles and then you do a simulation where you resolve the same lump with 10,000 particles, the properties of these lumps look extremely similar. So if you do this with gadgets, these lumps fall pretty much basically on top of each other. So in that sense, I would say that this is a solved problem. And so now we just need to understand how to paint galaxies on here. So a spectacular picture to wake you up. And that, of course, has to do with heating and cooling and star formation. And in the end, I hope we'll have a simulation like this, where you fly through the dark matter, but actually you can peel away the dark matter and see where the galaxies are. So these are one of our low resolution simulations. When you fly through the distribution of galaxies, you can look at the individual properties of the galaxies, compare them in detail, their internal properties, their statistical properties. That's what we want to do. And then, because it's a simulation, we can also, in the end, paint back the dark matter and figure out what is the relation between the galaxies and the dark matter. So you'll see the dark matter coming in a second. And then hopefully, within a couple of years, maybe the observers have caught up. And they can use weak lensing, not just to see where the galaxies are, the tips of the iceberg, but also how these are embedded in the dark matter. So I like this picture very much. Contrasting, so we talked about this many times, contrasting the dark matter halo mass function. So that's the black line, how many dark matter halos you have as function of mass. So M here is the mass of the dark matter halo, massive halos, low mass halos, the number of halos. This is the galaxy luminosity function. So this is a stellar mass, how many galaxies you have of that stellar mass. And these have very different shapes, right? These two curves have very different shapes. And so that's the aim of galaxy formation. Eh? We need to understand why you don't have these gigantic galaxies here. They're clusters of galaxies, really. Why don't these form gigantic galaxies? And vice versa, at low mass, why do we have very few faint galaxies, whereas we think, and we're probably right, there's many, very many little dark matter halos. And so, of course, traditionally, this is regulated by supernova feedback, so we want to have supernovae that prevent lots of galaxies forming if they're very small. And so that has to be very efficient. In fact, it has to get more and more efficient, or inefficient rather, as you go to lower masses. So here you can say, well, we know the gas in these massive halos is not in stars, it's in hot the barons. It's not in stars, it's in hot gas. This hot gas doesn't cool, but actually it does, and it would form stars. So we do need to prevent star formation in these massive halos. And so that doesn't seem to work with supernova feedback. And so in the simulation that I'll show you, we'll appeal to AGN to prevent those from forming. So the interesting aspect I find of the baryons here is that so we know, and at least as in simulation seems to be true, that there's very little transfer of power from small scales to large scales. That's why the dark matter, you can pick a scale and simulate all the scales above that without worrying too much. What happens in the dark matter, the scales that you don't resolve below that. So for baryons, that's not true, right? If your galaxy doesn't resolve stars, there's no feedback, and then we'll overproduce the faint galaxies. So baryons, you have transfer of power from small scales to large scales, and since we can't resolve these scales at the same time, we have a problem. So these are the challenges of theory in numerical simulation. So I mentioned some of these numbers already. So what is the minimum physics we need to include, and how can we get around that we don't do all the physics correctly? Well, we need gas cooling, clearly, otherwise we won't form galactic disks in which the stars can form. So we need that, so I'll talk about how that is done in the simulation. And clearly we won't have star formation, otherwise we can't compare against observations. And there's lots of physics that probably can't do, and in fact we won't do in the simulation. There's feedback from stars, absolutely crucial. So we'll do supernovae, but there may be many other mechanisms that stars don't like other stars in the neighborhood. There's black holes. I'm not going to say very much about that. We have some simulations with black holes and with the black feedback from black holes and the feedback from black holes. And then, of course, you have your simulation. You want to compare against the data. And I think where simulators have lagged behind a little bit versus simulated modelers is that we haven't done very much to make our simulated galaxies observable. But we should try better, do a bit better. So it's a lot big problem. You call in the American military, and then so here are the known knowns. Okay, these are the things we know and the things we can do. Then there's the known unknowns. These are the things that we know we can't do correctly, or we don't even take into account. And of course, then there's always the elephant in the room, the unknown unknowns. So how well do we do? So I'm going to show you a couple of slides to show that the simulations are not crazy. And then I'm going to talk about what is in them and compare them a little bit more qualitatively. So observed galaxy, simulated galaxy. I think they look a bit similar. That's maybe partly because of the color scale. But
the color scale, it looks pretty different.
What are you plotting in the simulator? Is that you both square?
But it's cosmic radiation.
Right.
So no, this is stars. This is trying to make the stellar component observable. In the same color band. So here's the Hubble Deep Field, and then here's the Gimmick Deep Field, or the Gadget Deep Field. Not impressed, okay. So there's a large group of people working on this. So Gimmick and Owls use the same simulation code. So that's one thing that you need to learn. It's the same simulation code. There's slightly different aspects of the formation of galaxies, but the same simulation code. And so these are the people that... So it's based on Gadget 3. So luckily, Volker Springel was on board when we were writing this code. So we added, as many people do, different subgrid modules to Gadget 3, which I'll describe. Star formation, stellar evolution, galactic winds, metal-dependent cooling. And that was mostly done by the people on here. But then luckily, we could collaborate with lots of other people to write papers about this, and so our family is growing. So we mentioned the solar Tom Cruise that wrote one of the papers. So that's for overwhelmingly large simulation. We are very modest in this aim here. So it uses this code that I'll describe in a minute. So what is particular about overwhelmingly large simulations is that they use periodic boxes with various box sizes. Okay, but they're periodic, so 25, 50 megaparsec, 100 megaparsec box. With a range of particle numbers so that we can look at convergence with respect to box size and numerical convergence, mass resolution, but importantly a range of physics. So some of this phenomenology that we're going to put in, the thing that we cannot resolve in the simulation, introduces them phenomenological parameters of which we don't know what the proper values are, or even functions that we don't know what they are. And so in the owl simulation, we vary these phenomenological parameters. Okay, I'll give lots of examples of that. Then we can do the learning aspect of the simulation, numerical experiments, people used to call this. So what is the effect of this parameter on that observable, say? Okay, so lots of different models, 50 plus models or so, with a range of physics, so owls. So GIMMICK uses the same code. So these are re-simulations of little spherical regions within the Millennium Volume. So by simulating a much bigger box, remember the Millennium Volume is 500 megaparsecs, so a reasonably large cosmological volume. And so we pick different regions in that so that we can say something about cosmic variance or the evolution between different densities. I'll tell you a little bit how we pick those regions. So then we do this simulation with one set of these parameters that we have in ours. Okay, we need to pick one, so we use one set. So for the last year or so, our group has been working up to EAGLE, which tries to combine the best of ours and GIMMICK to do an even better simulation, and eventually do a vulture, and everybody can go home. Right? So subgrid physics needed. So we need to form stars, however, in the simulation. So typically we'll have a resolution of a million solar masses, so much worse than a star. Okay, so that's just a particle mass, so maybe a real resolution is maybe a factor of 50 worse than that. So we can't even resolve molecular clouds, so let alone star formation. Okay, so our resolved densities are much poorer than the density that the stars form, so we need to do something about that. So I argued that supernova feedback is very important. So we cannot resolve or hope to resolve supernova blast waves. So we can't resolve the effect that does the supernova feedback. So we need to do something about that as well. So that's what I was saying. We use some effective or phenomenological description of semiotic model, if you want, right, for doing that. So that introduces an interesting aspect, namely that, so people then often ask, are your simulations numerically converged? That's a very tricky aspect because, in a sense, these phenomenological parameters should really depend on resolution. As you improve your resolution, you should actually change, I think, your description of your phenomenology. So that makes it then very hard to say whether it's numerically converged or not. So I like this slide, holistic approach. So I'm going to show that we introduce lots of physics, lots of phenomenology that is not really measurable in the lab. So we introduce lots of parameters there. And I think it's very important then to investigate all aspects of the model. I think if you concentrate all your effort on forming one galaxy, okay, I think there's a danger that you tweak your parameters to make exactly that galaxy. That would be very nice if you could make a nice Milky Way, but I still worry then to what extent that depends on how much you tweak your model. Okay, so what I want to be able to do is take one phenomenological description and then look at all observables, all the way from clusters of galaxies, groups, to Milky Ways, to their satellites, to the intergalactic medium, to reionization. I want to be able to do everything within the same model. So that's what I mean by a holistic approach. So these are some of the aspects that people have looked at in great detail, but as I said, I want to see whether in the same simulation I can do all these things, although maybe not first stars yet, but we'll get there. That is my nasty slide of the others that work on the same thing. So there's of course a whole group of people, or many different groups, that work on this, on various aspects of the same problem, very often using gadgets or other SPH codes like gasoline. Then there's AMR codes, ART, and REPRO. So I would say that, so my impression is that what shapes the galaxies at the moment is our ignorance, our lack of understanding in how to put in these subgrid models, rather than how well we can do the gravity for sure, and even how well we can do the hydrodynamics. Okay, I would think our limitations at the moment is more in that than in how well actually we do hydrodynamics, although eventually, hopefully, that will become important. So these are the four models that I want to describe. How we do the star formation, and what you need to take away is that our star formation in the simulations is guaranteed to follow a Kennecott-Schmidt law. I'll explain how this works. How we do feedback using galactic winds, how the simulation generates its galactic winds, how we do stellar evolution, and how we do the gas cooling, maybe the aspect that we can do best. So I don't know, I don't need to explain you what is the Kennecott-Schmidt law. So it's a relation between gas density and the surface density of star formation. So wouldn't it be nice if you came up with a star formation algorithm that gave the Kennecott-Schmidt law? Okay. So how can you do that? Also, maybe another thing to say about why it would be a good idea to try to get your star formation implementation so that it generates the Kennecott-Schmidt law. There's of course some averaging involved in measuring the Kennecott-Schmidt law. You need to measure the surface density over a given size of galaxy. No? You need to measure the star formation rate density over averaged over a given region of galaxy. And those kiloparsec scales, they correspond a bit to the resolution we have in our simulation. So in a sense, we're simulating the forming galaxy at a similar resolution as to where these data apply here. So how to obtain a Schmidt law? So we can't really get it from the interstellar medium because we can't resolve the interstellar medium. Okay. So in a sense, we need to make up an interstellar medium that has some effective pressure that is due to the supernova that we can't resolve. Okay, so we need to pressurize our interstellar medium so that not all the gas cools and forms stars immediately. And so Jupp came up with this formulation where if you assume that the height of the disk is the local Jeans length, you can... So the problem, of course, is that the Schmidt law is in terms of surface densities, where the simulation is in terms of volume density. So somehow we need to go from surface density to volume density. So Yorkshire suggested that we take the thickness of the disk of the order of the local Jeans length. Okay, in that case, you can translate between surface density and volume density. And if you work through the numbers, you find that the star formation rate density then needs to be a function of the pressure. So have a look at that paper to see how this works. But if you do that in a simulated galaxy, So this is now a simulation, surface density of the gas versus surface density of star formation. So the simulation follows, by construction, this Schmidt law, okay? So our Schmidt law is characterized by a cutoff. So we talked about this morning whether there is a real cutoff or not, but in the simulation there is, okay? So it's characterized by a cutoff, a normalization, and a slope, and these are three parameters of our subgrid physics, okay? So we set where the cutoff is, what the amplitude is, and what the slope is. And then the simulated galaxies, by construction, follow the Kennecott-Schmidt law. In fact, the scatter around this is much smaller than in real galaxies, so we do it much better than real galaxies. So very good. Right. So that's star formation done.
You don't put in any scatter in the actual relationship?
We don't put in any scatter, no. But we can, so we do, in ours, we vary these parameters. We do vary those. So then, so remember that in a high-resolution simulation, the mass of a particle is about 1,000,000 solar masses. So every star particle is here 1,000,000 solar masses. So then, of course, you need to assume an initial stellar initial mass function to then figure out how many supernova go off or so when you form a star particle. So how do we do galactic winds? Of course, you all know the very nice observational evidence for galactic winds from M82 nearby to CB58 in high redshift, where you see gas moving with respect to stars. We observe metals between the galaxies. How did they get there? Galactic winds. We need the galactic winds to push out the baryons. Okay, so we want galactic winds, definitely. Okay. So in the simulation, this is very difficult to organize because if the stars form in the high density regions, if you say, okay, we put a supernova heating in these high density regions, high density regions cool very quickly, nothing happens. So that's not going to work very well. So we want to do something else. So here's my attempt at doing some algebra. So suppose you form delta M star of stars. Okay, so you form so many stars, say 100 solar masses worth. And we know how much energy comes out in type 2 supernova. You say one supernova per 100 solar mass of stars forms. Times 10 to the 51, that's the amount of supernova energy that you get per star formed. And I want to somehow drive a galactic wind with us. Okay, so this is then the energy injection rate due to star formation. Some efficiency factor of how well supernova couple to the gas, okay, maybe one, times how many supernova you have per 100 solar masses worth of stars, times the amount of supernova energy per star, gives you this. So this is how much energy you have to play as you form stars, okay? So I'm going to use this energy to put that in a wind, okay? So here's my wind. So it has some mass in the wind, it has some wind speed, okay? Then maybe it has some thermal energy as well, okay? I'm going to forget about the thermal energy. Maybe there's other terms as well, I'm going to forget those. Just think of the kinetic energy of the wind. Ideally, my most efficient wind, I say, the kinetic energy of the wind is due to the energy I injected from the supernovae, okay? And so then you can put in the 10 to the 51 divided by 100 solar masses. That gives you a wind speed, 710 kilometers per second. And so this is the energetics of a galactic wind. Okay.
Where does the 710 come from?
It's 10 to the 51 ergs per 100 solar masses.
If all the energy, 100% goes into the wind.
So there's my eta t. If you say it's 50%, eta t is half. You look
if you just tell me how much energy you're producing, you still don't know what fraction goes into mass versus velocity, right?
No, exactly. No. This is what I'm explaining at the moment. It's exactly what I'm explaining. So then, so the previous equation, if I write m dot wind over m dot star, called the mass loading, is something times 710 kilometers per second. Okay. So I've lost the wind speed somewhere. Excuse me, I lost the wind speed. It's the wind speed divided by 710 kilometers per second. But as you say, I cannot really determine whether I'm going to put a little bit of mass in the wind, but give it at high speed, or I put a lot of mass in the wind and give it very low speed. Okay. But suppose, so the beta there, the mass loading, is how much mass you put in the wind versus how much mass you put in the star. Okay, so phenomenological model, we need to decide how to choose these, whether to put it in mass loading or to put it in wind. Okay, however, we want significant mass loading. We want beta larger than 1, okay, and maybe much larger than 1. Okay, otherwise we don't actually move any barons out of the galaxy. Okay, so if you do that, so if you put beta much larger than 1, then of course the wind speed decreases, and so so this type of galactic wind becomes inefficient for galaxies maybe a bit more massive than the Milky Way. Okay, so we know in advance we're going to do this, our feedback will become inefficient for massive galaxies, and in fact for low mass galaxies it's not particularly efficient either, because if we launch the wind with 710 kilometers per second, that is way overdoing it for small galaxies. We could remove, with that amount of energy, we could remove much more gas if only we decrease the wind speed. Okay? But at the moment, there doesn't seem to be, certainly in this theoretical model, an argument of how beta, say, would depend on the halo mass. Okay? So what we're going to do, at the moment, if we pick a wind speed, 600 kilometers per second, is that corresponds to a mass loading, 4, okay, and we run our simulation with these parameters. And then we know in advance that for massive galaxies there won't be any feedback, and for low mass galaxies there's some net mass loading.
Why would the wind be
right?
If you just think of the wind as something like you keep heating the IGN until it basically has
ISM,
until it basically has a velocity that basically drives itself out of the galaxy. That's a very natural picture to come up basically with a wind that basically effectively has a fixed.
Potentially. So I'll show you some simulations at the end where I can address that in more detail.
Not for things that cool faster than you can load them, which is all the things he's talking about. Only for the ellipticals where the cooling time is so long, so you just heat it and load it up.
Well, if the star formation rate is anything limited, then.
If my heating rate is faster than my cooling rate, then I hope
that your heating rate, you need to blow wind in one shot at the Milky Way and lower if you're going to do the wind speed.
No, it's not going to happen.
So fast.
Okay. But if you cool that much, you don't get such a large spectrum of the total energy into the wind.
Sorry?
If you cool that much, you will not get such a large fraction of the energy into the wind.
Exactly, right, you never do. Unless you do something funny to keep it from happening.
So I'll come back to that if there's time at the end. Right? So having decided what is the wind speed and hence what is the mass loading, a star-forming particle now kicks a neighboring gas particle with that wind speed. Okay. So the mass loading then determines how many neighboring gas particles you kick.
So it's not the star-forming particle itself that gets kicked. It's neighbors.
So the star-forming particle is a newly formed star, not a star-forming particle, sorry. So as soon as you convert a gas particle into a star, that star then kicks the neighboring gas particle.
I'm just, because that's different than how long remember that they do it.
Right. Lots of things different.
Yeah, I'm just trying to keep track of them.
Do you decouple the kick particles from the hydrodynamics program?
And so that's another effect, that the effective wind speed may be very different from the speed with which you launch the particles. Okay? And in fact, if you launch them, they may not escape at all. So that is the implementation of winds. So implementation of cooling, I guess we can do quite accurately. So here's the cooling curve as a function of temperature. So the different colored lines are the individual distribution contributions from the chemical elements you see there. So we track 11 species. Those are the species that dominate the cooling rate in this diagram. And so we have the three channels for element production, AGB stars, type 1 and type 2 supernovae. So that we track how much of these metals are released. These are then given to the neighboring gas particles, and we include those elements in the calculation of the cooling rate. And in fact, we also include the Harkin-Madau ionizing background, which decreases quite significantly the cooling rate because they get ionized and so they don't cool. So that's that. So these are the four aspects of the simulation. So the star formation rate is guaranteed to follow a Schmidt law. I described the galactic winds, the stellar evolution. So you need to pick some models of stellar evolution, of course. You need to pick some stellar lifetimes. You need to pick yields, okay? So that's not so obvious because some published values you don't get yields all the way from 0.1 solar masses to 100 solar masses. So you need occasionally to extrapolate, and then we do the cooling.
How do you spread the metals?
So I'll come to that a little bit, because that's a problematic aspect, of course, in SPH. So what we do so the star, so as a star particles in advance, we know how many metals are being produced from the previous time to the current time of these 11 species here. And so we SPH smooth those to the neighboring gas particles. Okay. But when we calculate some aspects, for example, the cooling rate, so every gas particle now has these 11 elements, okay? But when we want to calculate the cooling rate, for a reason I'll explain in a second, we smooth these again, okay? So you have a particle metallicity. And just like with the mass, you can use the SPH kernel to compute the local density. So with the metal mass, we compute the local metal density, and it's that one that goes into cooling rates. Okay, so it's not the particle metallicity, but the...
So you don't do this redistribution of metals over the SPH kernel every time set. It's only when you eject the metals from the stars.
That's right. But when we calculate, there's diffusion of metals.
No particle to particle diffusion.
That's right, yes. Yeah.
Where are the wind particles when you inject them? I mean, presumably there's some star-forming region and there's like many star particles next to each other and some wind particles around that. I'm trying to get a feeling for whether this is launched at 100 parsecs or a kiloparsec or...
So the typical resolution is the order of half a kiloparsec. That is a typical resolution. So that is the region over which we distribute our metals.
So do your winds actually get out because you're more, because by kicking a neighbor particle, you're more likely to kick something that's slightly out of the disk and therefore not deeply embedded in this dense region and runs into dense material and doesn't go anywhere?
You shouldn't think of these star-forming regions as dense knots, dense molecular clouds embedded in the disk. We really have relatively smooth disks because the pressure in the disk is imposed and is rather high. Because we say what we miss in the simulation is there's two aspects of feedback. There's one that drives the winds, the other one that pressurizes the interstellar media, and that one we don't have. So we do that by hand.
Right, so I'm comparing to, so you say that you don't turn off the hydro.
You don't turn off the hydro.
Whereas if you're, in the other model, if you're kicking out a particle that's in the process of turning into stars, and that'll be at a slightly higher density.
Right.
And there, the reason the hydro is turned off is because if it's not, then it just stalls and doesn't go anywhere because it's in such a dense region.
So
it doesn't actually get out.
So that doesn't happen here.
And I'm asking if that's because by kicking a neighboring particle, if those particles are preferentially at slightly lower densities and therefore have a shorter column to have to travel through in order to get out of the disk.
So they should be very similar densities to the star-forming particle.
Well, I mean, I'm wondering, it might matter on how well resolved or, you know, how many, you know, smoothing lengths thick a typical disk is.
So how does the actual pressure in your disk compare to the disks that you assume in your two-phase medium that you put by hand?
I'm not 100% sure how to answer that. What do you mean? It is set by the pressure height. So
you said you artificially pressurize it. So that's, but you must get a pressure that you just get from putting your feedback in too. You must be able to estimate what you would get.
So we don't get any. So we don't heat particles. So you don't get pressure from. So we said the increase in pressure is due to the feedback. It's not, how do I put this? It's not because we heat the particles in the interstellar medium.
It's an additional pressure term.
You can think of it as an initial pressure term. So in terms of what happens, so in the density, in the temperature density diagram, so as you go to higher densities and the gas becomes cool and dense, as you go to very high density, the pressure increases again in our simulations. Because we force it to. Basically, we do that to avoid artificial fragmentation so that we don't lose the genes mass there.
Also, in effect, in a way, you're counting some of the feedback energy twice, right?
That's true, because yes. We would say that it's a consequence of the feedback that if we could resolve it much better, we wouldn't have to do.
Right. You reuse the full energy.
True. But we don't use all the supernova energy, so there's a bit of energy left.
So can we think of this pressure as a turbulent pressure?
So I think you should see this as the fact that we cannot resolve a multi-phase medium. And this is our way of resolving or of modeling a multi-phase medium. Right. Maybe not too many movies, otherwise I won't get to the end. Let me show you this one. It's a pretty one. So this is a Milky Way-like galaxy forming. So in red you see the cooler gas that can form stars. In blue you see the hot gas that is being heated by supernovae. And so in the end you get lots of X-ray gas close to the star-forming disk. So then you get a pretty picture, you get a galaxy cluster, right? You get the gimmick deep fields, there you go. Right, so not too much now about gimmick, so lots of people involved. It's a flagship Virgo project, lots of people that have their names on the paper. So there's, the left is the Millennium Volume, right? 500 megaparsec, dark matter only. So we pick 5 regions in those, and we simulate those with high resolution and with the feedback that I described. And so we picked these 5 regions. The radius is about 18 megaparsecs, so there are hundreds of spiral of Milky Way-like galaxies per volume. So 18 megaparsec radius. And so we picked those to correspond, one region corresponds to a mean density region, and then there's one that corresponds to minus 1 sigma, 1 to plus 1 sigma, and to minus 2 sigma and plus 2 sigma. So we can then, in the end, investigate whether any of this depends on
on environment. Okay, so we include very large scale structure. So we simulate a cluster which is much more massive than you would ever get in a periodic box. Yet it still allows us good numerical resolution, and so we can run these simulations to redshift zero because our box is 500 megaparsec. We're not limited, that we're not worried that our box becomes nonlinear by the end of the simulation, and so we can see some unusual objects as well. So enough of that, enough of this. So I don't want to say too much about this. I like this plot very much. So remember, of course, there's lots of people that run their semi-analytic models on the Millennium. And so we have the same galaxies in the simulation as in the simulated models. And just look at this. So what is plotted here doesn't really matter, but it's a specific star formation rate.
Galaxies mean
the same halos.
Same halos.
Okay. Sorry. That's, yeah. On the y-axis, you have m dot star over m200 versus m200 at redshift 3. Okay. So gimmick is a black curve, and then you have two popular simulated models, and to me it looks a bit like this. But they meet somewhere, and so. So can you actually understand what is going on? So this is, again, the specific star formation rate, n dot star over m200 as a function of redshift for a given halo. So look at the massive halo. So you see, as a function of redshift, how, of course, its specific star formation rate drops. So compare that with the model of Runkes and Sprengel. These three red lines here, which correspond to different metallicities. Remember, in their model, it's dominated by the cooling. Okay, so hence it depends on metallicity. And so you can see that for a reasonable metallicity here, the models follow the simulation very well. Okay, so the massive galaxies, they do what Runkes and Sprengel said they would do. It's very good. A low mass halo doesn't follow this relation at all, because it's dominated by feedback. Its growth is limited very much by feedback. So let me skip that. So let me skip this.
What is low mass halos? What was the mass?
It's set somewhere.
50.
There you go.
50 to 100.
So I want to show you some of the other things. So a couple of words about OWLS. So remember the same code, periodic boxes this time varying these thermological parameters. So which one did we vary? So there's a whole range, and it's 50 models. So for example, there's a whole range where a whole set of simulations where we vary the stellar initial mass function. And so we heard about that this morning, so now you know everything about this. So then there's simulations without AGB stars. If we want to see what is the effect of AGB enrichment, we run a simulation without AGB enrichment. Without heat from helium ionization, without supernova, without cooling. Okay, it's very expensive. We vary the ionization redshifts. I mean, it's a whole different models. Okay, and so many of these variations don't have any effect at all. But some have a very large effect, and that's, of course, when you can learn something. So, to say something about intermezzo here, does your code integrate the relevant equations accurately enough? So, you have a couple of aspects here that I want to show you. I want to say something about isolated galaxies, metal mixing, radiative cooling, and entropy cores. Okay? So, this is an isolated galaxy simulated with two very different codes, with Flash and with Gadget. And this was part of the PhD thesis, more than rather smug looking Nigel Mitchell. So the Flash simulations are to the left, the Gadget simulations to the right. So remember, these are not cosmological simulations, these are isolated galaxies. And so they look reasonably similar, I would say. Okay? So look at the column without feedback, first the column without feedback, and the column with feedback, first the column with feedback. So it's maybe not exactly the same, but it's not dramatically different. Okay, so that's good. So some aspect of the chemical enrichment worries me a lot. So here's our star-forming part, the particle that has just become a star. It produces some metals and colors the surrounding gas particles red. Okay, so here are the metal-enriched particles, and so here's a shell of pristine particles. Okay, so now we're going to launch some of these in the wind. Okay, so then you get a situation like here, here's a star particle. So here you have a pristine particle sitting next to an enriched particle sitting next to an extreme, and a pristine particle. And so I guess the problem is how to interpret this. So suppose this is zero metallicity, this is pure metals, okay? Then you have something which is like half metal enriched, okay? So since the cooling rate is very dependent on metallicity, this particle could cool, whereas that one doesn't, okay? That seems to be in contradiction with this spirit of SPH where everything is smooth. This is clearly not smooth. So this is our, I think this is a significant problem in SPH, how to treat this. So what we do, that's why when we calculate the cooling rate, which depends on the metallicity, we don't use this particle metallicity here, but we'll smooth this metallicity over the SPH neighbors of every particle. Okay? So in this case, every particle would be half black and half red. Okay? So they would cool at the same rate versus this one cooling much faster than that one. So how much difference does it make, you would think, okay? If you use the particle metallicity versus the smoothed metallicity, if you do full cosmological simulation up to redshift zero, it makes a factor of two in stellar mass. Okay? The total stellar mass, all the galaxies together, is twice as high if you use the smoothed metallicity versus if you use the particle metallicity.
Yes, but it's far from obvious that the metal should mix. They could actually clamp on scales below your particle mass.
So if you can't resolve, that's true, but if you can't resolve it, then you can't resolve that. Right? There's no. So this may be true, but this is a purely numerical effect here.
So then do you have some diffusion so that, I mean, even so if you just smooth, then the metal enhanced particles will still always see a slightly higher metal, I guess, metallicity on average. So then you have diffusion between neighboring particles?
So we don't have any diffusion. You could have, but we don't have any diffusion. So people have tried to have some turbulent diffusion, but in the simulation there isn't any.
If you have diffusion, you have even worse sort of overcooling problem, because basically everything gets metal enriched and cools and forms stars.
Well, but you can compare this to things like Guinea Marcotte, where there's a fairly natural.
In the MR code, the mixing is numerical, right? But at least you have mixing. Yeah. True. And so that's.
So which one looks more like the MR code?
That's a little bit too extreme.
Maybe true extreme.
Some mixing. Numerical.
Yeah.
I mean, some mixing is just due to turbulence, and that's well resolved by the MR codes and not by gas.
And even we have. We probably have some separation by temperature too. So the hot gas can have a very different metallicity from the cool gas, and the hot gas it might mix well. And the cold gas you might actually just have clumps.
That's all very true.
You have more like dust clumps.
As you know, in SPH that is a problem, right? If you have a blob of cold gas in the hot surroundings, then you get the cooling rate wrong.
But you can get the global dynamics of the gas out for homes, and if you don't get that right.
Yes. Yeah, but I think this is especially a problem when, if you look at metals in the intergalactic medium, where you have this situation, right? It may contribute to cooling in halos. So, I want to say something about work done by Peter Kreese and other of my students, who looked at how well you actually do the cooling. So, if you look at verification of hydro codes, they always show you a shock tube problem, right? Where gas comes in on one side of your shock tube, runs into gas from the other part and gets shocked. Okay. But I'm interested not just in, well, of course very nice that the code can do a shock tube, but I was also interested in, so how does this work then if you include cooling? So I'm thinking of my gas accreting onto a hot halo, getting shocked and cooling. So can it do that problem? So here's the analytic solution. Okay. Here's the flash solution in blue. Okay, follows the analytic solution exactly. And here is the SPH solution. So what is going on here is that, as you know, in SPH the shock is broadened, and so the gas starts to cool before you get shocked, and so never gets hot. Okay, and so in fact it never shocks to the high temperatures that the analytic solution and the MR solution gives you. So that's not an intrinsic problem with SPH, that is a resolution issue. You need to resolve the cooling length here well enough in order to do the cooling through the shock correctly. So you can formulate that, and that's what Peter did, in terms of a mass resolution, given what is your cooling rate and given what is the metallicity of your gas. And so then Peter made this very complicated plot that I never understand. But it basically means that you need sufficiently high resolution, and resolution that is not too far from what we can do. So it is a serious problem, I think. But you can actually, if you have high enough resolution, show that it's not as bad as
you think. Resolution problem?
Of particle mass, yes. So how well can you actually resolve the shocks that appear? So the mass there is the mass of the halo, so that we have an idea of how strong the shock is. And hence what the real temperature is. So being in Santa Barbara, I can say something about the Santa Barbara cluster comparison project. Do you remember that? It was a non-radiative simulation of a cluster of galaxies. And what Frank and collaborators noticed is that there's an offset between the AMR codes and the SPH codes in the entropy profiles. So here's a smug-looking Nigel Mitchell again. So what he did what causes this? So we try to see whether this happens with binary collisions of clusters as well. So you do, it's another cosmological simulation. You set up a cluster with gas in hydrostatic equilibrium, and you smash two together, and you do that with SPH. You get this, and you do it with AMR, and you get that, okay? So these, curiously, both simulations are numerically resolved, numerically converged, okay? So the advantage of this not being a cosmological simulation is that we can do this at any resolution. It's not an expensive calculation, okay? So here is how SPH changes as you change the resolution, okay? Nicely converged, and here is slash AMR code, nicely converged. So worryingly, they converge to a different answer. So what is going on here? So what we think is going on is the generation of entropy through mixing in the flash case. Basically, if you think in the simplest case, if you color one cluster blue and the other color the other one red, in the flash case, the resulting cluster is purple. Okay. If you do this with SPA, then half of the cluster is blue and half of the cluster is red. Okay, so it's a lack of mixing, I think, in SPH that causes these steep entropy profiles. So I would think in this case, AMR has it right. So these are the four aspects that I mentioned. So isolated galaxies look reasonably okay. Metal mixing, I think, is an issue in SPH. Radiative cooling is not a problem in principle, but you do need high enough resolution to not suffer from that. And the entropy profiles is a worry. So the good, the bad, and the ugly. So I want to show you some of the results we get from the simulation. I'll start by the things that work well, and then slip in some things that don't work very well. So we have a whole series of papers on Milky Ways. So in the gimmick simulation, I misspelled totally there. I'm sorry. So we have a whole series of papers about Milky Ways, because we have several hundred Milky Ways in the gimmick simulation, all with a resolution of 10 to the 6 solar masses. So that gives you about 10,000 stars per Milky Way. It's not great, but it's okay. So we can look at how the properties depend on the environment. The answer is not very much. We can look at other aspects. So I'll show you something about the X-ray corona in these simulations. And at the moment, we are working on Tully-Fisher relation. But maybe what I found the most interesting is that we have a Hubble sequence now. So the same model produces both elliptical galaxies and spiral galaxies. So this is the disk-to-total ratio. You can argue, so the different colored lines are the different the five different regions in GIMMICK. So we haven't looked in detail whether that differs. So you may argue and say you still form too many bulge-dominated systems than disk-dominated systems. That is usually a problem in the simulation. We form some simulations, some galaxies that are almost bulgeless. So that's very good. But as I say, the numbers maybe are not in perfect agreement. So next week, Laura Salis will be here. She worked on this, so you can ask her more about because then you can look at, in the simulations, why does one galaxy become a spiral and why does another become an elliptical? Because the same simulation gives you both. So this is the thing that Ian McCarthy at the moment is working on. So this is the Tully-Fisher relation. This has been, of course, a big problem for simulations to reproduce. So this is M star versus V max. So the black points are gimmick galaxies. there's some faint data points from Verheyen. And these are the Bell and Jong fixed to the Baryonic-Tully-Fisher relation. And so this, I think, is a very nice aspect of the simulation. It does very well, okay, here. And it goes wrong there, okay? So two massive galaxies are far too Bell-dominated. They have rotation curves that don't look like rotation curves you see in real galaxies, okay? So those are wrong. And so it would be nice to understand why. But those work well. And I think the reason this works well is that the feedback is very efficient. And so a lot of the barons are thrown out, and the rotation curves are dominated by the dark matter. Okay, that's why the shapes are okay, and the amplitude and the normalization and the slope are okay. And that's also why these massive galaxies are not okay. These form in the simulation far too many stars, and they have rotation curves that
you
don't look like.
Stellar mass against the total mass, the sum of mass.
Yeah. We have that as well. So we're still working on that. So yeah. But I can show you. I don't have it here now. So these are shapes of rotation curves. So the cyan lines are observed rotation curves. So they're bent in stellar mass. So low mass galaxies, massive galaxies. So rotation curves in kiloparsec here. So cyan curves are observed galaxies. And then the black curve with error bars are the ones from the simulation, so the mean and 5% and 95%. And so I put some red lines here to remind myself what you say. So the low mass galaxies look okay. Maybe not in their centers. Maybe in the centers, the rotation curve still rises too rapidly as compared to the data. It is a problem. Well, the softening length is one tick here. So this is two softening lengths. So don't know. Okay, so it's potentially still a problem. But at the moment, I don't worry about too much because the resolution is so poor there in the simulations. Okay, you could say if the gravitational softening is too large, okay, it would rise even shallower. But so at the moment, I think it's unclear. Okay? In the other parts, I would say for these top row of lower mass galaxies, these look like observed galaxies.
It's total mass. That's the dark matter mass.
This is the stellar mass.
That's the stellar mass.
Yeah. So as you go to higher mass galaxies, then it goes wrong, right? So here are the observed galaxies, and all the beginning galaxies do something like that. And you can see, so the different colors here are the contribution to the circular velocity from star, from gas, so it's not due to the gas. This is dark matter, which dominates up there, and this is due to stars, okay? So clearly these more massive galaxies, they have very cheap rotation curves because they have too many stars. Okay. So our feedback is not efficient enough in the massive galaxies. And of course, that is related to the fact that we use 600 kilometers per second, right? I told you we pick a wind speed, then we know for galaxies more massive where the circular velocity is some fraction of 600 kilometers per second, our feedback will shut down, and there's nothing to stop star formation in these galaxies. And that's what they do.
There's no AGN feedback in
here. So that's, of course, an interesting aspect, right? Because these are not that massive galaxies. Hmm? So you may say, so where do you want AGN feedback to set in? Well, if it were up to me, I would know where, right?
It's relatively low mass. 11 and stars is quite a bit.
True. So I wouldn't argue with these here, okay? But still. So let me show you some other things. So I talked about X-ray halos of Milky Way-like galaxies. So, this is interesting that because in the original Frank and White model of galaxy formation, where you make a hot halo that then cools to form the disk, these hot halos have very large X-ray luminosities, much factor of 100 more luminous than observed galaxies. So that's a big problem. So do the simulations suffer from that? And the answer is no. So what is plotted here is the K-band luminosity of the galaxies, stellar mass of the galaxies, versus their X-ray luminosity of their hot halo. So the black points are the simulation and the colored symbols are the data. So what you see here is that for a galaxy of a given luminosity or stellar mass, the X-rays produced by a halo are in agreement with what you see in the X-rays from the observations.
So why is it lower than before? Because the gas is hotter?
So there's two reasons for that. Some fraction of the gas has made stars, okay, and the feedback has decreased the density, so due to entropy injection. So a combination of the two gives a factor of 100 in X-ray velocity, which of course is very dependent on the density.
It must be slightly hotter than the real temperature, so that you really decrease the density at the center compared to...
So in the center, the very dense gas got converted to stars, and that makes a big difference,
right? That's what you always had. That was even more converted than the other simulations.
Okay.
That you had more feedback, so it must be more that the gas that's staying, that it's so hot that you can...
So it depends whether you talk about the simulation or the original Frank and White paper.
No, I'm talking about the
original simulation.
So what about the total baryon fraction within the variables?
So these must be reasonable as well. So I showed you the M-star over M200, eh? So the stellar mass is fine.
No, but I want to know whether this X-ray gas, does that make up for all the remaining baryons that are not called the stars, or is still only about 50% of the baryons in the halo and the other
ones? It's a small fraction, it's certainly not 100%. So I would need to look at the numbers to see what fraction of the baryons are within the zero radius. So there's the same issue with groups. So if you do the same plot with groups now, well, the other way around for some reason. So now the y-axis is how many stars you have. The x-axis is the x-ray temperature of groups now. So there you see that simulation without supernova feedback produce much more X-rays than a simulation with, AGN feedback. So in the groups, the supernova don't do what they did in the galaxies, making the X-ray luminosity lower. So in the groups, you need something else. So for example, AGN. So it's in a sense, it's the same plot as here. So if I go back to this one, it's the other way around, right? So here it's stellar mass versus X-ray luminosity. So here's the supernova that make the X-rays of the gas much less than it would be without feedback, okay? But if you go to more massive halos, so here groups, the supernovae don't do enough, so you need an extra source of entropy to decrease the X-ray luminosity. And so if you do a simulation with AGN feedback, that works, okay? So for a given amount of stars, okay, if you include the AGN, you have much less
But if you would, given that this is all run with an SVA simulation,
right.
You know that the AMR codes give a higher entropy profile in the center, but would artificially put an entropy profile to what an AMR code would give me, would that also solve it, or do I need the AGN feedback?
I think you still need the AGN feedback even in the AMR simulation, yes. Yeah.
So these models, these results are simulations with AGN feedback?
With AGN feedback, yes.
So they can plot what the actual entropy profiles are that you have now.
The
X-ray profile for all these cases now the actual entropy profiles.
Yes. Yeah.
Have you done that?
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's a one-to-one relation basically between X-ray and the entropy. Yeah.
So where is most of your feedback energy actually coming out? At which wavelengths?
The feedback energy coming out.
And you put now more feedback in,
right.
Less X-rays. In the end, a lot of the energy that you put in the feedback is related to the gain. So if it's not coming out in X-rays anymore because the gas is too diffuse.
But you change the distribution, but it's a feedback cycle. Huh? So it's related to how much energy the black hole accretes.
I'm not talking about your last simulation.
Right.
Basically, put a lot of supernova feedback energy in to push a gas out. You don't get it out in the X-ray anymore because you said you've solved the problem, there isn't too much
You talk about the previous problem.
Does it all come out as lime alpha or in the metal lines, or where does it come out?
You talk about the galaxies, or about the groups.
Galaxies.
Right.
If I think now of the observations, the feedback energy that you put in to large fractions radiated away, maybe not early on, but then later on. So it must come out at some wavelength.
So I'm not 100% sure I understand which situation.
He puts it in as mechanical energy.
Right.
So you want it to heat and cool, but it doesn't heat and cool because the stuff stays out and then.
That's never perfect, as you know.
Yeah. I think it's stronger stable than that.
So you will put in 100% PTV work.
I mean, there's still an X-ray luminosity, right? You just reduce the X-ray luminosity because you're density.
Yeah, but you have put more energy in, so in principle, there should be coming more out than in the old simulations. so it must come out at different wavelengths.
I don't quite follow what you said. I mean, there's much less gas that cools, right? It's the cooling gas that produces the X-rays, and there's much less gas that cools.
No, that's not true, I think, because you put several times the thermal energy in, and the gas can actually normally only cool once. So you get its thermal content once, and that's actually not that much. And that's already would exceed your X-rays. Now you put feedback in that exceeds your thermal content. And normally, because your feedback isn't completely efficient and a large fraction, you really gets much worse if you put the AGN feedback in. You put even more energy in, and most of it is just radiated away, it's more radio. But it has to come out somewhere. So if you bring the X-ray down, it has to come out a different wavelength. It's probably coming out of Lyman alpha.
But what's your...
They aren't heating the gas. Their feedback isn't heating the gas. It's just...
But at some stage, they solve the full thermodynamic equations. And there's some dense clumps that are cooling.
What's your energy input rate versus the X-ray luminosity? Is it much more than the X-ray luminosity?
Good question. We could translate, because... So if these have star formation rates of the solar mass per year, then it's about 10 to the 51 Earths per century, which you then just need to convert to Earths per second. And then divide one by the other.
Yeah, we know what the answer to that one is. If I just fill the halo with the gas and that is cool, so there would be too much X-rays. That's already in Franke White analytically. So that's just once the thermal content in the gas and the halo.
Right.
So much excess you don't get.
I think you sort of assume that the gas first cools, emits all its X-rays, and now I heat it up again. It's not what happens.
Assuming that I put a lot of energy to push it out, and while I'm doing...
I don't put it out. I prevent it from coming in.
So you're adding heat, so you're effectively reducing your cooling. That's why effectively your X-ray must go down.
It's okay, I can discuss it later.
How much longer do you want me to go on? So, let's see what I can... I can show something bad. Okay.
Those outlier points?
I don't know. There's outliers. But ugly is the stellar mass function. So the stellar mass function doesn't work. So this is the stellar mass function at redshift 2. So there's some data points here, and the different colored lines are the different gimmick regions, okay? And so here you would say, it's not obviously wrong, okay? But at redshift 0, it looks really bad. So here's the stellar mass function.
It's pretty wrong.
And there's the data. Now, so at massive galaxies, we don't care, because we knew already this would go wrong. Okay, so I'm not particularly worried about these massive galaxies. Okay. Going to very low mass galaxies, I'm not too worried either, because that has to be at some stage a resolution effect. Because the very first star to make, remember, stellar mass, the mass of a particle is a million solar masses. Okay, so I think this is a low resolution simulation. So the mass of a particle is now 8 times higher. So 1.2 times 10 to the 7 solar masses. So even if you form one star in your halo, that can be already too many. Okay. So these low mass galaxies, I'm not too worried that these are wrong. That has to be to some extent resolution, because you don't have a previous generation of stars that generates the feedback. Right. So then you can ask, so how many stars do you need before it's resolved? Well, I don't know, 100 or 1,000 or so. So I wouldn't worry too much about this steep faint end slope here. Okay. So then there is a region where the stellar mass function is flat. The amplitude is too low, in a sense, because maybe our feedback is too strong. So we do produce a bit of a flat part of the stellar mass function, and it goes wrong here due to the absence of AGN. And in fact, so I should have brought Richard Bauer's plot, but he can reproduce exactly the shape of the gimmick stellar mass function by catching, in Gauss form, they kick barons out of the halo. That's the way feedback works as well. So if he says, well, actually, if the halo grows in mass, this gas is recaptured, then he gets exactly this tail here. So this is basically recaptured gas, which got kicked out of the halo. The halo has grown in mass, the gas comes back. Okay, that's what powers these very massive galaxies. And so to prevent this from happening, you need some other mechanism to quench the star formation here.
So if you fix that, then there'd be a lot more lower mass objects, which might solve some of the deficit.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. But so in a sense, we have a good idea now, and that's where ETO comes in, to see how to... So the other thing you could do, of course, is to make the feedback parameters dependent on halo mass. But that's sort of a nasty thing to do, but that would be another option. So then what you need to do to make a mass loading very high in low mass galaxies with a low wind speed and a high mass loading, and have a high wind speed with low mass loading in the high mass galaxies.
It's a bit surprising, right? Because many simulacral models in the old days, they never included agent feedback. They always had an overabundance of massive galaxies, but I can't remember any simulacral model showing this dip.
So have a look at Richard Bauer's 2012 paper.
Exactly. In retrospect, the simulacral models can represent.
All right. Things. Yes.
But I think they never came up with something that looked like this.
No. All the Bernier semi-algebraic models always assume
they're always fit
factor in. Has a steep circular velocity.
Exactly. So there's no dependence here.
But this is a square dependence, right?
No, there is. Yeah.
No, there's no dependence.
The looping factor here is constant.
Yeah.
And the velocity is constant, which is why they're getting the weird behavior. That's what he was just saying. If you have the mass loading factor scale with mass, then you don't get this.
I think the old semi-algebraic models were all designed to get a flat mass function. That's how they were set up in the first place. That was one of the observables they tried to fit first. So that you don't necessarily get that if you don't aim at it.
You're going to get features at the velocity that you have your wind velocity at.
So the thing that worries me a little bit is that you say, so as you said, there's some characteristic scale here below which the wind is efficient, above which it isn't. So it seems that somehow the AGN knows about that. As soon as the wind stops being efficient, the AGN takes over.
But that's only if your modeling of the wind is correct, which is...
Or your wind perfect.
Why would your modeling of the wind be more correct than any of the other scale?
No,
why would wind velocity be constant? I really don't think that that's a reason. I find it a really weird model.
There will be some wind speed here. You say as you go to more and more masses.
No, you effectively model the wind speed being independent of halo mass.
Yes. Okay.
As you looked at correctly, that was very different from what everyone in any simulacral model land has ever done.
Right, and that's why we get these steep.
Now you're saying, well, it's weird that the AGM should know about this, but
I think it's
that's
more
really under the postulate that your wind model is correct.
So I would say that may solve part of the problem going to lower masses. That won't solve this year, unless you say that your supernova really have wind speeds of 49 kilometers per second. So I want to show something about that, and so let me skip all the nice things. So captain feedback. So it's my student again. So this is what I was saying. So what is the relation between supernova going off and the driving of a wind? So these are now simulations no longer cosmological, of a cylinder of interstellar medium. So here is the disk plane. Okay, it should be characterized that by a given surface density. Okay, so the Schmidt law then tells us what the star formation rate is, and the stellar evolution model then tells us how many supernovae we have. So very different from the previous simulation. The resolution here is now less than a parsec, and so we can now resolve individual supernova explosions. And so these then combine to drive a galactic wind that you see here. So you see it in temperature and in density. And now you can ask exactly the question that you sent here. So this is how it then looks like. So this is your cylinder, right? So this is perpendicular to the disk. Here's the disk. And so you see temperature, density, velocity perpendicular to the disk, and the pressure in the disk. The damage that the supernova do to your forming, to your galactic disk. And so now you can calculate from the simulation what is the speed with which stuff flies out of your box. Does that depend on resolution? The answer is no, because we have such high resolution that we actually resolve all the cooling that goes off in the supernova shells as they overlap. And so you can calculate or measure rather, what is the wind speed, and then you can vary your surface density and do the simulation again and see whether there's a relation between wind speed and surface density. And that's, in a sense, that's exactly what you were asking. Is there some relation? If you then integrate that over your disk, you can find a relation between effective mass loading of the wind and the mass.
So do these take into account radiation pressure from the massive stars before the supernova explodes?
No.
First question.
So at the moment we just inject thermal energy when the supernova goes off.
Because the people who are including radiation pressure find that there's a dramatic difference between the morphologies and the wind speeds, the mass loadings you get when you do or do not have that effect.
So how does it stratify? Is this inside a dark matter halo?
So initially it's in hydrostatic equilibrium, okay. But very quickly, that is that becomes.
Slab model kind of thing.
What's the units on the y-axis there for the wind velocity?
It's the height. It's the color that gives the speed. Ah, here you mean.
Yeah.
So it's hundreds of kilometers per second.
So yeah, can you just give some numbers? There are no numbers on the ticks.
Right. I don't know. But it's hundreds of kilometers per second.
Okay.
But I mean, is there a dark matter profile in the background?
So we're very close to the disk here still. Okay, the height here is only half kiloparsec, so we're very close to the disk here.
So the ambient medium has constant temperature, constant density?
No, it's a... This is the temperature density, it's not constant.
So you're forming stars in a disk,
right?
And then things are exploding into an ambient medium. Or is there just vacuum in the ambient medium?
No, so it's initially in hydrostatic equilibrium. Initially, the profile is in hydrostatic equilibrium.
So there's a scale height.
So there is some sort of effective dark matter.
Right. There's a surface gravity.
Okay.
There's a surface gravity. Yeah.
It's just like an exponential atmosphere profile.
Yes.
Okay. It's less than a couple parsecs of dark matter.
So that will become important eventually. So I think enough now. Did I have anything else to share? No. What about that? Thank you.
So you mentioned the radiative cooling, and the one thing that you mentioned there was the shock tube issue.
Right.
That you're modeling the radiative shocks seems to be problematic unless you go to sufficiently resolution.
Right.
There have also been these claims now with the repo that the pure cooling is also different between RAM, repo, and GET, right? But quite a bit. And the angular lengthening issues. So, what is your view on should we continue with GET or should we modify it to better capture certain aspects of the hydro?
So I think at the moment the outcomes are mostly determined by. So I think that is exaggerated because the simulations that you're referring to don't include many of the things which are very important in GET simulation. And so I think at the moment. So should we work on a repo? Of course, no? You can do it better? Absolutely. Is that why repo galaxies are different at the moment from investigation galaxies? I would say no. It's because we do, there's millions of other reasons that the way all these other processes are implemented are probably have a much bigger effect on the properties of the galaxy that you form than the hydrodynamics.
What's Forker's take on that?
Well, you have to ask him. No? But if you look at it,
you might have discussed him more recently than I have, I think.
So
as he has stakes in both camps, he might have an opinion on it.
If you look at the Aquila paper, where the same galaxy simulated with all different codes, the biggest outliers are Ramses with AGN versus Ramses without AGN. Okay, they encompass all the other models.
Because the AGN are put in a crazy way.
Yeah, but
right, but some of this aspects of how much mass
but
a repo and AMR is exactly the same.
and was curious about it. It sort of seemed the other way around. Like, we always have the impression with this pH that we're always overcooling because of that smoothing.
Right.
But it sounded like in the recent calculation, it's always the other way around.
Yes, exactly. It's very, very
nice. I mean, do you understand that?
No. But I think Falk has been looking at that for a year or so.
I think if. Obviously, the difference between the physics are 5 times as large as the difference between the hydrodynamics, then you should work on the physics. But if they are similar, or maybe 2 times, if you get the hydrodynamics wrong, you might converge on the wrong physics to get the observations right. So if the hydrodynamics makes differences, they are nearly of the same order, then it seems to be more prudent to sort that out first, so that afterwards with the physics you can actually converge to the right result. Because otherwise you might solve problems.
But it's a complex problem, right? What do you want to do? You want to write a code that does the shock tube with cooling perfectly well? Or do you want to write a code which you can do galaxies?
No, I think that's unfair. They basically take galaxy formation examples and show what goes wrong there.
Properly take care of physical processes, and the ones that basically can be done with the simulation should do well. Mm-hmm. And I think, I think it's very interesting and worrying that this is exactly about this metal mixing. Mm-hmm. It makes effectively 2 different instead of masses.
Yeah,
and I completely agree with Mark. You don't first sort that out, then what's the point in trying to find the feedback mechanism?
But if you switch off feedback, you convert all gas to star. And it's much bigger.
Then you'll come to a wrong conclusion about what the feedback.
Right.
So there's many parts in the plots you showed where he's off, we're all off that back over 50.
Right.
In that sense, it's sort of sensible to say, okay. First, we should even ask ourselves, can any implementation of feedback be done in such a way that you get something halfway reasonable? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Almost independent of whatever you put in any physical sense. Just get there roughly. I mean, now you're like, oh, far as magic. I mean, there's a couple of plots once in a while that don't look too bad, but anything else, you look bad.
It's not yet a precision galaxy.
I think there's an exception.
Exactly.
Exception, right? And so in that sense, I agree that because we're actually not sure that a hydro is the right thing anyhow, right? There's the B fields and the cosmic ray pressures, and there's a lot of issues that go in there. But what we've definitely learned is that the feedback is the huge thing that makes all the difference.
No, I totally understand that if it's all about software physics, then why the hell do we need to do simulations, right? Then we can use some little model. The advantage of the simulations over some little models is that we capture correctly the cooling, we do that correctly. Well, apparently not.
No, I actually don't at all.
So then why are
we? It's much, much smaller than any scale in this whole problem.
Great. So that's where I'm getting at. So isn't it more important to get that?
You can show that dramatically in a 1B calculation, and you actually, even that one parsec that you show in this is not enough to resolve the cooling thing.
And so what density?
I can give you, but it's sort of the density you would have in the IS thing. So exactly how that shock separates from if you picture material falling in vertically onto the disk, you need fractions of a parsec to actually capture the onset of the first, heated layer.
If that is correct, how can the event layer converge?
It totally matters. Oh, because you're light years away from it. I mean,
right. That's my. If you're the event layer converges, then you'll study where it can change things back at 2. Where you want it, I want to see change things back at 100. Okay. Yeah. And then you're convincing me that things are converging. Back at 2 within the noise, you've never seen it.
Oh, where does that that length scale come from? Is that field length?
It's the cooling time times the sound speed. It's just the crossing length that you have. And you can now construct problems quite easily.
For what temperature?
Well, for this entire range, right? So here we are where you have the 10 to the 4 Kelvin, the peak of the Lyman alpha cooling one. This is now the question. If you're not getting the cooling length there, it can happen to you that you always have this cold flow regime. You think you're in this perfect cold flow regime, where what would have happened if you had the resolution. You actually made a very thin hot layer at first that can't grow, just expand in size. So you,
I mean, the claim in the star formation literature is that you don't converge unless you resolve the field length, which is absolutely tiny.
Exactly. That's already.
I mean, that's even smaller than the length scale you quoted. I mean, that's if you have thermal conduction in your simulations.
So I would also interested in what they showed. So these are. Did those people look into what's going on? Why these differences are so dramatic?
No.
Bohr et al. Has a very, very stable.
This was the Lucia et al. And
what was the other one? Bauer 6.
Sorry?
Bauer 6.
And Bauer et al. The Lucia is a standard least squared.
Yes. Is the Lucia 2006 or later one?
It was 2007.
Later they changed this to a constant loading factor as well.
In fact, the rigid has now a constant mass loading as well.
Okay.
So he claims he can get almost equally.
But actually, I have another argument against a constant loading factor.
Against?
Against.
Okay.
Because even you get a mass function right, then what you have is the stellar mass decreases rapidly with decreasing tail mass. Okay, if you have a constant loading factor, when you form a smaller and smaller amount of stars, then your feedback loading is also small. Then you will end up with a large gas mass over stellar mass ratio for small halos. That will give you a very high H1 mass function.
So that's quite plausible. I don't think Richard has looked at that. But what he would say,
I want to go there.
What you would say is that so if this mass function turns up again, that's fine because we don't observe it. So, but he hasn't looked at H1, I think, so that might as well be a problem.
I think what Yulu said, as long as the slope is less than -2, then you get decreasing stellar mass with halo mass. And so that means you have less and less ability to push out gas unless the mass loading factor changes.
Yeah, and also this the scale you were pointing is 10 to 8, right? And the H1 mass is almost one order of magnitude lower. Even you here, you have a steep stellar mass function.
Right.
I'm not sure whether that will hide the problem.
I don't know. Yeah.
So does a model like with that implementation of the winds, how does it do in the 9 alpha stars?
Thank you for that question.
And what island is that?
Southern Island. So H1 in absorption.
One peninsula.
So in H1 it works perfectly. So this is Gabriel Alphae's radio transfer post-processing cells to do the cell fueling calculation. So it's called urchin because it's reverse ray tracing. So we start from dense particles, we trace out to probe the ionizing background, and then use optical depth along those rays to determine the cell shielding. This is the over 10 orders of magnitude in number density and 10 orders of magnitude in column density, the column density distribution. So all the way from DLAs to the integral limit of Lyman limit systems, to counting lines in the Lyman alpha forest, with one simulation going through the data from the weakest lines to the strongest lines you see.
But isn't it true that if I turn off the winds completely, I get an equally good
effect? So it makes very little difference in the Lyman alpha forest. Eh? We know that before. And so here it does make a difference.
Okay, so we're looking into which models.
Yesterday Alexei complained that if he tried to mimic what you do with this code, he just doesn't get the cutoff light. He gets too many high columns system, whatever.
But it's obvious what he does wrong. But I guess we should find out. It's clear what he does wrong, though, I think.
You know him, he's normally he said he looked at it and he just doesn't understand why. And he said he tried to put a multi-phase mating like you do, pressurize the disks, whatever he does, he's never able to get that. He always gets many more high columns systems. Any idea, or?
I think
maybe you should discuss directly.
Exactly. I think we have a good idea of what is different between
you. You have a good idea.
Yeah. Check in.
It's a secret.
Yes, yesterday he claimed he has no idea, but the day before yesterday,
So since we're writing the paper about this, maybe I shouldn't. But I think we have a good idea of why it is.
Okay.
But that works very well.